welcome. This is Rob bringing you this week's edition of the Talking Newspaper for St Albans, Harpenden and all the villages. This is the Red Saturn programme for the week ending the 21st of April 2018. Our music today is called Eventide. Once again, it's from Goffby. Once again, he's performed his magic on his computer. I'll play the whole piece at the very end, as well as sections of it in between the parts of this programme. And this week, those parts are, first of all, a selection of news stories from this week's edition of the Hearts Advertiser, and that's followed by some suggestions for programmes on national radio that you might enjoy this week. Thanks once again to Sue for producing those. Then in part two, a couple more articles from Hertfordshire Life magazine. The first article was published late last year as part of the anniversary of the Russian Revolution in 1917. And it looks at some intriguing connections between our own county of Hertfordshire and the socialist uprising. Then a couple of shorter pieces. The first is the thoughts of a regular contributor to Hertfordshire Life as she thinks back over a recent visit to Haworth in Yorkshire, the home, of course, of the Bronte sisters. And the final piece is all about a local dog fosterer and an innovative scheme that finds temporary homes for pets. In part three, the sixth and final piece about Islam. Akhtar Zaman, president of the St Albans Islamic Centre, explains why human rights is a central issue for Muslims. This is, in fact, the last of the individual pieces. We've had six on Islam, six on Christianity, and six on Judaism. And next month and the month after, we come to two final roundtable discussions between the three community leaders where they look at what they've said and perhaps look for common ideas and themes between the three religions. Right, over now to our readers for this week's stories from your local newspaper.
Hello, I'm Bill, and my first story today is about housing and the St Albans local plan. The title is Don't Dump All This New Housing on Our Doorstep. Anxious politicians are worried the south of the district will become a dumping ground for development in the new St Albans local plan. As part of a consultation at the beginning of the year, St Albans District Council asked for help to find space for 3,000 extra houses to add to the 5,000 new homes already identified for development in built-up areas. However, of the total number of hectares submitted by landowners, that's 2,246 hectares, more than 50% are in the south. That's just over 1,160 hectares up for development in the parishes of St Stephen, London Colney and Colney Heath. Notable developments include 140 hectares spanning St Stephen and London Colney at Harper Green Garden Village, 97 hectares in Colney Heath on Tittenhanger's Highfield Farm, and 119 hectares in Park Street on the rail freight site. Only 10%, that's 237 hectares, of the proposed hectares are in Harpenden Town, Harpenden Rural or Wheathampstead. This does not include eight settlements pinpointed by the council, including Southern Chiswell Green and London Colney, but also Hemel Hempstead to the west and Northern Harpenden. Chairman of London Colney Parish Council, Malcolm McMillan, said, "This is just not on. The public are really concerned that the infrastructure cannot support the development. It would be chaos, absolute chaos. We could not possibly have all these sites. It's the same old story. When they need development, it always goes in the south. We don't want to be a dumping ground for development, and we will be campaigning against it behind the scenes and in the open to make sure we don't have all this development. We have already had our share. We've done our bit for homes in the city." He noted that not all of the suggested sites will be chosen to be included in the local plan. Hearts County Councillor for London Colney, Drida Gordon, said, "We recognise that more homes are needed for families and young people, all sorts of housing, and the answer to that is for more houses to be built. The big question is where? I have always recognised that the South should take its share, but it should be a fair share, that the other areas take their share too. The impact on our infrastructure is huge, and there has been a significant amount of development in the south over the last 20 years. St Albans residents were overrepresented in the consultation compared to responses from Harpenden, Redbourne or other areas. About 60,000 leaflets were delivered to every home in the district notifying them of the consultation. Vice Chairman of SADC Planning Policy Committee, Councillor David Yates, said, "It's good that we have such a good response to the consultation. Officers have done a great job. But where do we go from here? A lot of the excitement will be about the call for sites, the fact that the large areas are all in the south of the district. If they were all chosen, it would be an urban area, effectively." He believes residents could see a silver lining if enough new houses are built to justify a new secondary school. The north-south development issue is not new. In 2012, the Hearts ad reported that the development sites being considered for the now-failed strategic local plan were around Smallford, Park Street and Brickett Wood, all in the south.
I'm Deborah, and my article is entitled "How Social Prescriptions Hope to Ease Pressure on Surgeries." A doctor's surgery is now offering social prescriptions to tackle well-being problems in a non-medical way. Patients at the Malting Surgery on Victoria Street can now book in to find solutions for problems that might have physical symptoms, but for which a clinical treatment is not the best option. For example, a person who gets headaches due to loneliness could go to the Malting Social Prescribing and Wellbeing team and be signposted to suitable social clubs or community initiatives. Extended 30-minute appointments are run by fully trained volunteers, and the service runs alongside normal 10-minute GP appointments. Practice business manager at the surgery, Susan Trounce, said, "The NHS is stretched, and being overstretched, there are lots of people who need support that is not always medical. We need to look at health in a holistic way, looking at everybody's medical, physical, psychological and emotional needs, and this approach ticks all the boxes." In its NHS Reality Check update 2018, the Royal College of Physicians said NHS England statistics showed bed occupancy rates was now at around 95%, 10% above the recommended safe level. The Patient Participation Group, PPG, at the Maltings helped to set it up after a successful 8-month trial last year by winning a £2,500 grant from St Albans District Council and the Citizens Advice Bureau. The surgery is working with Citizens Advice to create a comprehensive database of social prescription options. With 18,000 patients registered at the surgery, it is hoped this new project will help to ease pressure on appointments. Susan added, "GPs have always been concerned about overall health and well-being holistically, not just medical health, but also social health and well-being. However, in a 10-minute appointment, the doctors tend to focus on medical issues, as they do not have time to discuss social issues as well." Social prescribing is a national initiative, gaining traction with clinical commissioning groups around the country. Appointments at the Malting Surgery are available on Wednesday afternoons and Friday mornings. Call the surgery on 01727 855500 to find out more.
Hello, this is Penny. Fears for infrastructure as new homes proposed. Infrastructure issues have come out as a top priority for residents affected by widespread development plans in the St Albans local plan. Out of approximately 2,400 people who responded to the consultation on the new St Albans local plan, most were concerned about infrastructure issues and protecting natural spaces. The local plan makes provision for 15,000 new homes to be built in the district between 2020 and 2036. That figure has been calculated by the government and is expected to be imposed on St Albans District Council, SADC, as part of the new National Planning Policy Framework. As 81% of land in St Albans is classified as Greenbelt, portfolio holder for planning at SADC, Councillor Mary Maynard, has stressed that some will have to be sacrificed. 8 separate settlements have been identified to take on the majority of the building, and which have been identified by council officers as least harmful to Greenbelt objectives. These are North West Harpenden, North East Harpenden, north of St Albans, East St Albans, land at London Colney, land at Chiswell Green, East Hemel Hempstead South and East Hemel Hempstead North. Creating completely new garden villages on Greenbelt land was ranked the least desirable way to achieve more homes in the district by residents. Residents also mostly disagreed with expanding existing settlements into the Greenbelt. They were most worried about roads, but also doctors and schools. Small to medium-sized family homes were perceived as most needed, followed by first-time buyer flats, and then affordable rented housing. Councillor Maynard said, "The first thing is I was really pleased there were more than double the number of people than last time who responded. Many people responded again, but we had a whole new group of people, particularly young people, so it's great to get their views in the mixture." 20%, the highest portion, of people who responded to the consultation were over 65. Only 13 people between 16 and 24 submitted responses, which is up from zero in the failed strategic local plan. She continued, "The big concern is infrastructure, and it's an issue we have to address and a concern we share."
Hello, my name is Leslie. The headline of my first piece reads, £1.5 million to help disabled children run like the wind with new sports prosthetics. A Harpenden campaigner has welcomed the news that another £1.5 million has been set aside by the government for disabled children. Sarah Hope has been pushing for child amputee rights since 2007, when she was involved in a crash with her mother Elizabeth and then two-year-old daughter Pollyanna. They were hit by a bus mounting the pavement near London's Mortlake station. Elizabeth was killed, Sarah was seriously hurt, and Pollyanna lost her leg. In 2012, Sarah became outraged that the NHS could only supply Pollyanna with a static leg. She lobbied Parliament for running blades to be made available for all children with missing limbs. In 2016, the government conceded to the pressure and allocated £1.5 million for new sports prosthetics, with more than 200 children benefiting from the extra funding. Now a second lump of £1.5 million is being allocated to buy more running blades and to support research into developing prosthetic technology. The plans were announced by the Care Minister, Caroline Dinenage. Sport and activity are so important to any child's health, well-being and confidence, and today's announcement should help many more disabled children to fulfil their sporting ambitions. Hundreds have already benefited from the fund, and this additional investment will now help us to open up even more possibilities for children with limb loss and hopefully ignite in them a lifelong passion for sport. Sarah won a Pride of Britain Award in 2017 for her role in the campaign. She said, "Children are born with a desire to be free to run like the wind, join in with sport, to play with their friends and to walk without difficulty." Adding, "We must always remember that amputees are missing a part of their body, so we really need to give them the very best we can so they can try to live the life they were born to live." After the incident, Sarah also set up the charity Elizabeth Legacy of Hope and opened the Sarah Hope Line, a confidential support service for people involved in London traffic accidents. For 10 years of unfaltering charity work, Sarah has also won the Point of Light and the Hearts Ad Community Awards Parent in a Million accolade in 2016.
It's the final countdown for the opening of Museum and Gallery. After 2 years of work restoring the city's Georgian Town Hall, the £7.75 million new Museum and Gallery will finally open to the public on June the 8th.
the Free Museum aims to showcase more than 2,000 years of heritage and host art exhibitions showing treasures both local and from around the world. Visitors will also be able to enjoy national touring exhibitions from other UK museums for a small entry fee. Permanent displays in the Grade 2 listed building will tell the story of St Albans District from the pre-Roman era through to modern times. The story starts over 100,000 years ago, when hunter-gatherers first arrived in Britain, and the museum will feature Roman treasures and evidence of Boudicca's revolt. Visitors will be able to learn about the city's role in the War of the Roses and see how St Albans played a part in the lives of Sir Francis Bacon, Sarah Churchill, Duchess of Marlborough, the Ryder Cup founder and former mayor Samuel Ryder, and the more recent local figures Stephen Hawking, Stanley Kubrick and Jim Rodford. When the museum opens, it will feature its flagship exhibition, First Impressions, telling the story of St Albans' printing industry, including the Hearts Advertiser. The museum will be set over three floors, with a number of restored historic spaces, including the assembly room, courtroom and prison cells, as well as newly created galleries to host exhibitions and events. Glazed links that have been added to the first floor, enabling visitors to walk around the entire building and take in views of the city. A basement gallery has been excavated under the building to host national touring exhibitions and art shows, and the ground floor has been renovated to accommodate a learning studio, visitor information point, gift shop and cafe. St Albans Museum and Gallery trustee Annie Brewster said, "This has been a complex and challenging project, and everyone associated with it is working incredibly hard to be ready to open to the public. We look forward to experiencing life being breathed back into this magnificent building, as was intended by its 19th century creators."
Convent redevelopment work, disrupting neighbours' lives. Neighbours living near a former care home claim the redevelopment of the site is causing unnecessary disruption to their lives. Beechcroft Developments are in the process of demolishing the Maryland Convent on Townsend Drive in St Albans and building 35 retirement homes, some costing as much as £950,000. But Alan Lawrence, a resident of Townsend Drive for more than 30 years, said the work is pelting their homes with dust, causing unacceptable levels of noise, and contractors often leave them blocked in on their driveways. Lorries come off the site and go along unpaved road, which is like a quagmire when it's wet. They have a road sweeper that spreads muck across the road, and when it dries, a dust cloud follows the lorries around. The 73-year-old says he has seen contractors parking on double yellow lines, which were put down for safety reasons. Just a few weeks ago, the road and pavement outside his home was dug up so an adequate power supply can be run to the development while work is carried out to create an underground car park. St Albans District Council initially refused Beechcroft Development's planning permission. However, their application was allowed following an appeal to the planning inspector. Mr Lawrence, who lives with his wife, said, "I cannot go out of my drive. We knew there would be noise, but we were not expecting the levels we are getting at the moment. Developers have made very little effort to engage with us about it. We received notification that this work was taking place, but they do not seem to care what disruption they are causing." Trevor Wicks from Beechcroft Development said, "I do not consider dust to be much of an issue, but we use water suppression to keep it down. Workers on the site can only play radios inside the property, not outside, and the work on the electricity line is by the utility company, and Beechcroft has no power over them," he added. Mr Wicks had seen an email from Batchwood resident Paul Robertson, who complimented the developer on its traffic management and courtesy. Mr Robertson had spoken in opposition to Beechcroft's proposal at a St Albans Council planning meeting last year, saying they had declined to consult with residents, referring to a previous application by the developers after they bought the site in 2015. And the article's accompanied by a picture of the former Maryland Convent.
Footy fans stroll to £2,000 goal via London stadiums. A group of football fans are embarking on a 50-mile, 12-hour walk to raise money for bowel cancer research. Six friends who call themselves the Stadium Strollers are visiting all the London arenas which have hosted Premier League football along the route to Wembley Stadium on June 2nd. They will walk from Queen's Park Rangers Loftus Road to Stamford Bridge, Craven Cottage, Selhurst Park, The Valley, London Stadium, White Hart Lane, and then on to Emirates Stadium. They hope to reach the final stop, Wembley, for 5:15 p.m. in time for England's final match before the 2018 FIFA World Cup in Russia. The Stadium Strollers hope to raise £2,000 for the Bobby Moore Fund, a branch of Cancer Research UK set up by Stephanie Moore, the widow of the former England captain who died of cancer in 1993. One of the strollers, Cameron Miller, said, "We're all taking part in this event for the Bobby Moore Fund because with us all being big supporters of our national team and being too young to have witnessed Bobby Moore play, all we've ever heard is stories of the great man who tragically died at such a young age. By raising money for the fund, we hope it increases the chances of the next generation being able to hear legendary football stories firsthand." The strollers consist of Cameron, 22, his brother Callum Miller, 24, their cousin Rich Biggs, 25, Craig Jenkinson, 25, Elliot Gibbons, 23, and Joe Peacock, 23. He added, "By doing this, we hope to unite fans of our national team in the run-up to the World Cup by remembering a true World Cup-winning hero. This is one of the toughest challenges we've set ourselves. Knowing the money we raise will be used to fund bowel cancer research throughout the UK is the best part of all. To train for the Mammoth Ramble, the Stadium Strollers are walking from St Albans City Football Club ground off Clarence Park to Watford Football Club's Vicarage Road in May. Bobby Moore captained the England team to victory in the World Cup 1966, winning BBC Sports Personality of the Year award that year. Help the strollers reach their goal by donating at Just Giving, fundraising, Stadium Strollers."
World War I centenary is the right time to end long-standing Anzac Day commemoration. Veterans and military personnel have commemorated soldiers from Commonwealth countries in St Albans for the last time. There has been an Anzac Day service at Hatfield Road Cemetery for more than 25 years in memory of soldiers from nations including Australia, New Zealand and Canada. The service in St Albans particularly remembers those who came to the city for medical treatment during the First World War, many of whom were subsequently buried in Hatfield Road Cemetery. However, this year marks the final service to be held in St Albans because many of the veterans have now passed away. Nearly 100 people attended the service, which was led by Canon Reverend Tony Hurl and included a short address given by Reverend Andrew Prout of Hatfield Road Methodist Church. St Albans Mayor Councillor Mohammed Iqbal Zia, representatives from abroad, veterans from various military associations, the British Legion and local cadet forces all attended the service. Rob Tillotson of the St Albans Army Cadets said, "It was good. It was the first year we have done it to pay our respects and remember those who go to conflict, and it is a chance to visit the Commonwealth graves, which is something the cadets don't normally get to do. I can obviously see why it is stopping, but I think it is a shame. Even if no one is there, it would be good to get a service in place to remember those soldiers in their passing." The cadets were led by Detachment Commander Gary Clark. St Paul's Church Administrator Helen Chilton said, "It went really well. It was wonderful because we were lucky with the weather and we were able to be outside. We were very blessed in that way." She described it as the right time to end the tradition, as it is a century since the end of World War I. The service ended with refreshments in St Paul's Church and an opportunity to chat with the foreign visitors in attendance on the day. Although the St Albans service was held on April the 15th, the official Anzac Day is on April the 25th. This marks the 1915 date when the 1st Australian Imperial Force and New Zealand Army troops both landed on Turkey's Gallipoli Peninsula at around dawn. Just the next year, in 1916, Brisbane citizens voted unanimously to establish the Commemoration Day. And there are pictures of the parade with regimental flags and one of the veterans laying a wreath.
The London Marathon runners who are inspired to compete on behalf of Rennie Grove Hospice. Two Harpenden residents are taking on the ultimate running challenge, the Virgin Money London Marathon, to raise funds for Rennie Grove Hospice Care. Matt Elvidge is Sales and Marketing Director at local brewery Far Brew. He said, "I've enjoyed running for a number of years, but never run an official marathon, so I decided it was time to take on this challenge. I've been training during the winter months and I'm running to raise money to help support the amazing Rennie Grove Hospice Care, who do so much for anybody that needs their help. Most of us will be touched by a form of life-limiting illness at some point in our lives, either through direct relations or close friends. And I hope that people like Rennie Grove are always there to support us all through these difficult times and not leave us to face these challenges alone. This charity offers the patient and family specialist care at home, along with counselling and group therapy to ensure mental, emotional and physical support for all those affected by the illness. Far Brew is proud to be a corporate sponsor of Rennie Grove, and I hope that by running the London Marathon, I can go one step further to helping them in their work. Alex Rajman is also running to raise funds for Rennie Grove. Rennie Grove is a cause very close to my heart after I witnessed the care and support they gave to the fathers of my two closest friends through their battles with cancer. I hope to complete the race in less than 4 hours. Both Matt and Alex have set up JustGiving fundraising pages. Please visit justgiving.com and search on their names if you would like to support them. Running a marathon may be the ultimate goal for some, but for those who are looking for something more achievable and closer to home, then why not consider the Harts 10K? This is a multi-terrain course through the Hertfordshire countryside, starting and finishing at Rothamsted Research in Harpenden, and is taking place on Sunday, October the 14th this year. Visit harts10k.com for full details.
Winners of 2018 Dragon's Apprentice Challenge help raise thousands for Ollie. School pupils have raised £22,000 for charity through a range of innovative business ideas in this year's Dragon's Apprentice Challenge. 110 pupils from 13 schools across the St Albans district celebrated their victories at both junior and senior levels, where pupils are tasked with making as much profit as possible from an initial £100 investment with the help of their designated Dragon business guru. Team Verulam Enterprises came up with the idea of a discount card on behalf of the Ollie Foundation and scooped the Best Innovation and Presentation Award while also raising £3,000 for the charity, which works to raise awareness of teenage suicide. The foundation's co-founder, Stuart Faulkner, said, "Part of our charity is about awareness, and although fundraising is a great thing, it's the raising awareness we want to promote, so anything we do to engage with the community is good." Team Unity from St Albans Girls' School were the overall winners of the Senior Challenge, which is open to Year 12 pupils, as well as the joint winners of the Best Use of Social Media accolade. Their schoolmates from Team Accord won the prize for most profit generated, while Team Moving from Nicholas Breakspear School won Best Partnership with Charity and were joint winners of Best Use of Social Media. Team Phoenix from Sir John Law School won Best Display for an exhibition held before the awards evening, and Team Empire from Samuel Ryder Academy won special recognition for attempting to link up with another school to organise a colour run after their own school council could not accommodate it. Kate Newton, acting chief executive of volunteer organisation Community Central St Albans, which runs the annual challenge, said, "It was fabulous seeing the students' enthusiasm for their partnered local charity. Many of the charities that will benefit this year are very small and are struggling with funding. Many of the young people said knowing their money would have a direct impact on improving the lives of people was the highlight of the challenge for them." The Dragon's Apprentice Challenge has generated £475,000 for local charities over the last 9 years, and we thank every single student, business dragon and charity partner for contributing to this phenomenal success. And the article is accompanied by a picture of Team Verulam Enterprise and another smaller picture of Team Unity.
This piece is about what our restaurants and cafes are doing about plastic waste. With a growing local and national push against plastic waste, we asked what St Albans restaurants and cafes are doing to cut down. A new campaign, Plastic Free St Albans, has been started to raise awareness of the issues locally, following in the footsteps of hashtag refuse the straw. The Coffee Ethic Cart at St Albans Council offices offer a 20p discount for people who bring their own cup or reuse a cup, and will shortly be using biodegradable packing for everything, including cups. The managers of the Courtroom Cafe, due to open at the new museum and gallery, Leafy, say they will use 100% compostable cups, and the museum is considering selling branded reusable cups. Council Head of Community Services Joe Taverner said, "When entering into agreements with catering operators to run coffee carts, cafes or restaurants from properties that we manage directly, we take into account their approach to sustainability and their contribution to the community. Hatch, which has outlets in the Maltings and Holywell Hill, gives 30p off to people who bring their own cups, and also uses Vegware, which looks like ordinary cups, straws and cutlery, but is made from biodegradable starch. Inn on the Park in Verulamium offers its customers a 10% discount for bringing in their own cup, and is currently working on how to reduce the amount of plastic they use. Cafe on the Corner on Catherine Street offers a 30p discount to people who bring in their own cups and is looking at a range of other ways of reducing waste, including selling their own reusable cups and taking part in Sustainable St Albans Week at the end of this month. They also say when they order takeaway cups, they make sure they are recyclable. Charlie's Coffee and Company, which has a shop on London Road and a van at City Station, takes a slightly different approach. It sells its own cups for customers to reuse. The owner of Courtyard Cafe on Hatfield Road in St Albans, Michael O'Shea, said they now recycle all of their plastic and are looking into selling reusable cups made out of bamboo. He said, "I saw a picture of a turtle with a straw up its nose, and that was the trigger for me." The cafe also had a Christmas tree made of plastic bottles donated by a local school last year. The Oval Cafe in Harpenden say they are looking at vendors who can supply biodegradable cups and straws but do not offer a discount for people who bring in their own cups. Reverend Simon Carver, the minister of Dagnall Street Church, which houses the Cross Street Centre Refectory, said they don't use much plastic as their produce come from butchers and greengrocers. He said he would think about offering discounts to people bringing in reusable cups for takeaway drinks. Gale's Artisan Bakery on Marketplace in St Albans offer customers a 20p discount for bringing in their own cups and is also looking into how to reduce their plastic waste. Italian restaurant chain Carluccio's is removing plastic straws from all of its 103 outlets over the next few months. Chief Executive Mark Jones said in 2017, Carluccio's used 1.5 million straws across its UK businesses and around 500,000 in London alone. Removing plastic straws is us playing our part in reducing the volume of plastic that significantly damages our environment and wildlife. Waitrose, which has stores in St Albans and Harpenden, is removing all plastic cups by the autumn. Head of Sustainability, Tor Harris, said, "We realise this is a major change, but we believe removing all takeaway disposable cups is the right thing to do for our business, and are confident the majority of customers will support the environmental benefits. It underlines our commitment to plastic and packaging reduction, and our aim is to deliver this as quickly as possible."
Question Time is coming to St Albans for the first time and is looking for audience members to hold their panel to account. The BBC's popular political programme will be at the Sandpit Theatre on Thursday, May the 3rd. Presenter David Dimbleby said, "I'm very much looking forward to bringing Question Time to St Albans for the first time. What really matters is that we have a lively audience who want to speak their mind. It's a chance for people in St Albans to get their voice heard, not just by politicians, but right across the UK. The panel has yet to be confirmed, but producers are looking for people to apply to be in the audience via the website bbc.co.uk/questiontime or by ringing 0330 123 9988. There are approximately 100 people in the audience, selected to ensure political balance. The panel is made up of government and opposition representatives, political commentators and celebrities.
And now a couple of music events coming up in St Albans. Claire Martin, regarded as one of the finest jazz vocalists in the world, will be performing at Hearts Jazz Club in St Albans next week. BBC Radio 3 presenter Claire will be joined by singer-pianist Leanne Carroll at the Maltings Arts Theatre on Tuesday night. Lynn recording artist Claire Martin has spent the last 30 years honing the craft of jazz singing. To worldwide critical acclaim, she has established herself as a tour de force on the UK jazz scene, gaining an OBE for her services to jazz along the way. Pianist-singer Leanne Carroll is a soulful, emotive artist capable of moving an audience to tears or have them jumping for joy with her breathtaking vocal virtuosity. A Hearts Jazz spokesman urged fans to get their tickets now for this very exceptional gig. Advance tickets for this intimate night of song with two award-winning jazz singers cost £12 for members, £15 for concessions and £16 for a full-price ticket. The tickets cost more on the door. Visit the website at heartsjazz.co.uk. And also next week, St Albans Chamber Choir presents an evening of Bach's brilliant cantatas at St Saviour's Church. The choir's festive Bach concert on Saturday, April the 28th, also features soloists from acclaimed local concert group Amici Voices. Performing will be mezzo-soprano Helen Charleston, winner of the 2018 Handel Singing Competition, together with period instrument ensemble Laws Baroque Players, led by Harpenden-based violinist Miles Golding. Bach composed more than 200 cantatas for up to four soloists, a four-part choir and an orchestra for Sundays and holy days at the churches where he was musical director in Leipzig. The concert contains four written for the period between Easter Sunday and Whit Sunday, including Bach's earliest cantata, Christ lag in Todesbanden, excuse my German accent, translates as Christ lay in death's bonds,
composed when he was just 22. The conductor will be the choir's musical director, John Gibbons. Tickets are £15 and £5 for children and full-time students.
And I have news of another concert, entitled Lunchtime Music. A St Albans GP will be performing at a city centre church next week. Wednesday's free lunchtime recital at St Peter's Church will feature Julian Godley, bass, and Nicholas Robinson, piano and organ. Their programme for April the 25th is due to include Mozart Sarastro's aria, O Isis und Osiris, and Arise Ye Subterranean Winds by Purcell. Songs by Schubert, Glinka, Ireland and Quilter will also feature. It starts at 1 p.m. Julian, a GP at the Malting Surgery, was head chorister at King's College, Cambridge, under Sir David Wilcox. As a cellist, he was soloist in the Elgar Cello Concerto. At Cambridge, he sang with the University Chamber Choir under Richard Marlowe, and in London in the Taverner Consort under Andrew Parrott, and in the Academy of St Martin's in the Fields under Sir Neville Mariner. He currently sings with Cambridge Baroque and the Orchestra of the Swan. In 1983, he co-founded the St Albans-based vocal group, the Brockett Consort.
A pub customer was left shocked when he popped into his local for a drink and walked out with an 11-kilogram Easter egg. Retired pharmaceutical consultant Peter Thomas found out he had won the egg when he visited the Old Bell in Luton Road in Harpenden. He said, "I bought some raffle tickets for the egg as I'm a regular supporter of the charity involved, Hertfordshire Action on Disability, but I never thought I'd win. Now I'm in the process of seeing if I can donate it to another worthy local cause. It's true it goes well with a glass of red wine, but such a cocktail could have serious health risks. The egg, which equates to 1.7 stone in imperial, was made and donated by Lesseters in Woolmer Green. A collection of chocolate treats donated by Amelie Chocolat in Welwyn Garden City was won by runner-up Sammy Jade Bennett. Hertfordshire Action on Disability provide equipment and transport to disabled people." And there's a wonderful photograph here of Peter with a glass of red wine standing beside the most enormous Easter egg.
A 9-year-old railway fan became the 20,000th recorded visitor to the St Albans signal box. Ryan Frake was travelling home from Margate to Nottingham with his family when they stopped to visit St Albans South signal box on one of its open days. The signal box has opened regularly to the public since 2008, and Ryan was the 20,000th visitor. He was presented with a souvenir entry ticket, and further mementos from his visit were sent to him afterwards. Ryan's dad, Bob, said, "Our son Ryan was fascinated not only by the signal box, but by the passing trains too." Signal Box Trust chairman, Tony Furs, said, "It is a huge achievement on the part of the Trust and its members to have reached this milestone in the story of the St Albans South Box and its restoration. It was a delight to welcome Ryan and his family, along with all the other visitors who ventured out on what was a miserably wet afternoon. The signal box is next open to the public on Sunday, April the 22nd, from 3 p.m. to 5 p.m. And there's a picture of Ryan and his family standing under an umbrella in the rain, but still looking very pleased with his souvenir entry ticket.
That's the last of the news stories from this week's Hearts Advertiser. Now for some suggestions about radio programmes that you might find of interest between Saturday 21st of April and Friday the 27th of April. On Saturday the 21st of April, at 6:30 p.m. on Radio 3, Opera on 3 features Coraline, a fantasy tale of which this is the world premiere operatic version of a Royal Opera House production, staged at the Barbican in London. At 8 p.m. on Radio 2,
in celebration of Her Majesty the Queen's 92nd birthday. A special concert will be broadcast live from the Albert Hall with many varied artists, including Sir Tom Jones and Kylie Minogue. Also at 8 p.m. on Radio 4, Archive on 4, The Long Shadow of Canary Wharf marks 30 years since work began on the skyscraper officially known as One Canada Square. Journalist Jane Martinson speaks to those in East London who have grown up and old in its shadow. On Sunday, 22nd of April, Craig Revel Horwood sits in for Elaine Page on Radio 2 at 1 p.m. His playlist includes music from The King and I, The Jazz Singer, and Dirty Dancing. The Drama on 3, on Radio 3 at 7:30 p.m, is an adaptation of Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice, transposed to the City of London during the 2008 financial crisis. The magnificent Andrew Scott takes the lead as Shylock, with an introduction from the BBC's business editor, Simon Jack.
A look now at programmes that run on each day through the week, from Monday. Radio 3 is running a week of late evening programmes titled Night Blossoms, exploring the unexpected, the shadows and the countercultural in Japanese music and arts. These are running from 10 p.m, so tune in if you're interested in Japan. At 9:45 a.m. on Radio 4 FM each day, Book of the Week is Sharp, The Women Who Made an Art of Having an Opinion, by Michelle Dean, about the social and political progress of women through the 20th century, beginning with Dorothy Parker, who became one of the most brilliant wits of 1920s New York. Radio 2 is featuring a funny fortnight, with two programmes each day from 10 to 11 a.m. from Monday to Wednesday this week. Tune in for a dose of comedy in specially commissioned panel shows, quizzes and sitcoms. At 10:45 a.m. and repeated at 7:45 p.m. on Radio 4 each day, the 15-minute drama is Curious Under the Stars, the return of the comedy drama set in the mysterious coastal village of Glan Don. On Radio 3 each day at midday, Composer of the Week this week is Barbara Strozzi. This programme explores her life and music, beginning with her childhood among the grandest artistic circles in 17th century Venice.
And now some picks for each day of the week from Monday to Friday. On Monday 23rd of April on Radio 2 at 11:30 a.m, Michael Palin and Jane Milligan continue their celebration of Spike Milligan on the centenary of his birthday, with extracts from recordings made in the 1980s. The Art of Immersion on Radio 4 at 4 p.m. is about whether virtual reality's fantastical spaces can offer new ways to make and experience art. And Jane Jones presents the Full Works Concert on this St. George's Day, with a concert which celebrates English composers on Classic FM at 8 p.m. On Tuesday, 24th of April, and for the next four evenings on Classic FM at 8 p.m, Jane Jones presents the cream of the Full Works Concerts from 2018 so far. Former motorsport commentator Murray Walker offers this sublimely entertaining insight into Dorset's annual spectacle, the Lawnmower Race. First recorded in 2004, Grasshead Racers is on Radio 4 Extra at 8:30 p.m.
On Wednesday, 25th of April, the Beach Boys classic God Only Knows is the title of this edition of Soul Music on Radio 4 at 9 a.m. The song is used to investigate how its lyrics affect other cultures around the world. The afternoon concert on Radio 3 is at 2 p.m. and is live from Media City UK in Salford, the home of BBC Philharmonic, with the music of Berlioz, Ravel and Ferenc. At 11 p.m. on Radio 4, 6 Degrees of John Sessions has the actor, raconteur and impressionist telling entertaining stories linked to him, interspersed with impressions, one-liners and intriguing history. For those of you who can get the BBC World Service, Outlook at 12:05 p.m. and repeated at 6:05 p.m. comes from New York, where Joe Pascal invites interesting people to the Hudson Union Society. This month, it is Mae Jemison, the first black woman to go into space, and also the first real-life astronaut to appear on Star Trek. On Thursday, the 26th of April, to mark the centenary of Spike Milligan, Radio 4 Extra is rerunning 5 episodes of The Goon Show, unheard since their original broadcast in 1955. The programmes are at 8:30 a.m., 12:30 p.m. and 7:30 p.m. Pure joy for Goon Show fans. On Radio 4 at 11:30 a.m., Guilty Architecture visits buildings with a controversial history and asks whether they should be restored or left to crumble. And Annika Rice hosts the Radio 2 Arts Show at 10 p.m. with all the latest film, art, theatre, dance and music across the country. For Friday 27th of April, But Still They Come on Radio 4 Extra at 8:30 p.m. explores Jeff Wayne's progressive rock version of H.G. Wells' The War of the Worlds, and features Richard Burton, David Essex, and Jeff Wayne during the original recording sessions.
Thanks very much to our other readers today, Deborah, Penny, and Leslie. Just before we go on to more of our theme music for this week, let me give you the names and ages of those whose deaths are announced in the Hearts Advertiser this week. Eric Stanley Parrish, age 93. Robert Barry Davidson, age 63. Sydney James Bushby. And Sylvia Towsey, age 92.
Hello, I'm Terry. Hertfordshire and the Russian Revolution. War, revolution, love, diamonds, theft and tragedy. Hertfordshire's links to the Russian Revolution have it all. To mark 100 years since the socialist uprising, Martin Elvery investigates the intriguing connections. The leafy lanes and peaceful towns of Hertfordshire must have seemed 1,000,000 miles from the seismic waves of revolution that shook the vast empire of Russia a century ago this month. Yet there are fascinating connections between the county and the events that transformed Imperial Russia into the Soviet Union. Prior to the uprising, Russia was a strict autocracy ruled by czars who, since the early 17th century, had been members of the Romanov family. It was a regime known for its huge contrast between fabulously rich aristocrats living in palaces packed with art and peasants or serfs working on the estates of the great lords in conditions not much better than slavery. By the beginning of the 20th century, there was a burgeoning working class in cities, including Moscow and the capital Petrograd, St. Petersburg, working in the grim but growing factories, and a university-educated intelligentsia brimming with ideas about how the Tsarist regime could be reformed or overthrown. The revolution of 1905 led to the creation of a national assembly, the State Duma, but the compromise satisfied neither Tsar nor reformers. In March of 1917, Russian troops were pursuing the continued punishing fight against the Central Powers on the Eastern Front of the First World War. The conflict was going badly for Russia, with heavy defeats on the front and great hardship in the country due to food shortages and inflation. The mood was increasingly turning against the war and its military commander, the Tsar. It took the spark of street protest to undo 300 years of Romanov rule in days. Thousands of women marched in Petrograd on National Women's Day protesting against bread shortages. They were joined the following day by workers and students carrying placards stating, "Down with the Tsar!" When Nicholas II ordered the military to put down the disorder, troops mutinied and joined the protesters. Riots ensued across the capital, targeting the regime. Within 10 days, the Duma had persuaded Nicholas II to abdicate. An interim provisional government was formed, in reality sharing power with the radical Petrograd Soviet, a council elected by workers and soldiers. Voting to continue Russia's role in the war, these new powers were opposed by a small socialist clique, the Bolsheviks, led by Vladimir Ilyich Ulyanov, also known as Lenin. The group called for a peace treaty with Germany, the redistribution of land from the rich to the peasants, and the transfer of power from the bourgeois government to the new People's Soviets. Its slogan was "Bread, Peace, Land." By October the 25th, after mass defections from the front, worker strikes and conflict between the Bolshevik Red Guards and the military, the Bolsheviks had gathered mass support and seized power by force in the capital, overthrowing the government. The Bolsheviks clung to power through the turmoil of a hugely bloody civil war against counter-revolutionaries that followed the coup and forged the world's first communist government and a social, agricultural and industrial revolution. The old order was swept away, including the assassination of the former Tsar and his family, including his youngest brother, Michael. Just 4 years before his murder, Michael was living in another world with his family in the tranquility and social order of a stately home in Hertfordshire, albeit in exile from his homeland and at the heart of a royal scandal. In 1913, Grand Duke Michael Alexandrovich took a lease on Nebworth House and moved in with his new wife, Natasha. She had divorced her musician husband to marry a cavalry officer before falling for one of his friends, Michael. The Duke tried to buy off his love rival with money and a government position, but in a move that shocked society, the jilted husband challenged Michael to a duel. Nicholas sent his brother away from court in order to suppress the scandal. In 1912, 2 years after Natasha gave birth to their son, Michael shocked the Russian court by marrying her. Nicholas reacted with fury, confiscating the Duke's estate, banning him from the line of succession, and exiling him from Russia. Michael and Natasha left for Europe, first Denmark, then France, Switzerland, and finally England, where his cousin George V had recently come to the throne. The couple spent a year at Nebworth, living in a style to which they would have been accustomed in Imperial Russia. The lease included stable lads and housemaids, a gardener, cooks, a butler, and 14 footmen in powdered wigs and knee breeches. Natasha later said the family's time in Hertfordshire was the happiest of her life. The couple hosted the stars of the Russian ballet and the opera, who were on tour in London at the time, in the stately home's drawing rooms, libraries and picture galleries. Letters show that the couple's children, Tata, aged 10, from Natasha's previous marriage, and George, aged 3, loved life at the house and enjoyed playing and riding ponies in the gardens. Photographs taken at the time show the family gathered happily together. Current Nebworth custodian, Henry Cobbold, says the story of Michael and Natasha is one of the great doomed love stories of the 20th century. Nebworth House was the setting for its one happy spell, he explains. an idyllic honeymoon year in the English countryside, away from the disapproval and troubles of the Russian court. To think that Diaghilev and the stars of the Ballet Russe would pop up from London for the weekend. What an extraordinary time. It makes me think of the 1980s film The Shooting Party, which was all shot at Knebworth House and represents that exact same period. Although, as is often the case with Knebworth House, the truth is much more extraordinary than the fiction. The family's happiness was to be short-lived. When the First World War broke out in 1914, Michael decided he must serve his homeland and begged his brother to let him return. Nicholas relented, and Michael took command of a cavalry regiment on the notoriously bloody Eastern Front. When Nicholas was forced to abdicate in 1917, Michael was next in line, but his position was never ratified. He was imprisoned and later murdered, aged 39, by the Bolsheviks in Perm in eastern Russia in June 1918, the first of the Romanovs to be killed. His wife had pleaded with Lenin for his release. Michael's child and wife also had tragic ends. George, driving to the south of France, died in a car crash. Natasha lived out her years in obscurity and died in a Parisian charity hospital, aged 71, in 1952. It was another love scandal surrounding a Russian aristocrat that began Hertfordshire's other strong links to the Russian royal family. Another Grand Duke Michael, this time a grandson of Tsar Nicholas I, began his career by following the traditional route demanded of him as a Russian aristocrat by serving in the military and the government. However, in 1891, passion got the better of him, and he eloped with the Countess Sophie von Merenburg, a daughter of Prince Nicholas William of Nassau and granddaughter of the Russian poet Alexander Pushkin. Their union was a scandal. Sophie was of much lower social status than her husband and was not allowed to inherit his titles. Because of the scandal, the couple were banished from Russia by Tsar Alexander III, Nicholas and Michael's father, and lived in various parts of Europe before relocating to Kenwood House in London. Their daughter, Countess Anastasia Mikhailovna de Torby, later styled Lady Zia, married into the wealthy Werner family, who owned the lavish mansion Luton Hoo, now a hotel, spa and golf course, on the Hertfordshire-Bedfordshire border. Her husband, British Major General Sir Harold Werner, had distinguished himself on the Western Front in the First World War and had inherited part of the wealth of his father, Sir Julius Werner, who had built a huge fortune in South African diamond trade. The marriage in July 1917 caused a stir in English society newspapers, one of which proclaimed Zia a vivacious beauty, a favourite of society, and an able horsewoman descended from Catherine the Great and Genghis Khan. The marriage was attended by Lady Zia's relative George V and Queen Mary, a frequent visitor to Luton Hoo, at the Russian Embassy and the Chapel Royal in St James's Palace. The couple lived a splendid lifestyle at the opulently appointed Luton Hoo. Letters show they attended at least one high society party every weekend. Zia built on a huge collection of paintings, jewellery, porcelain, silverware, furniture, wood carvings and tapestries amassed by her father-in-law. She had a Russian Orthodox chapel built at the house, now the Romanov room used for blessings and events, and brought a fabulously rich collection of Russian treasures to her home, including around 300 pieces fashioned by Russian court jeweller Fabergé. The Queen and Prince Philip spent two nights of their honeymoon in November 1947 at Luton Hoo, returning each anniversary until the 1970s when Sir Harold died. But this story too has a tragic end. On Lady Zia's death in 1973, Luton Hoo and its fabulous art treasures passed to the couple's eldest grandson, Nicholas Phillips. But saddled with increasing debts, he committed suicide in 1991. The house was then sold off. 3 years later, and now a hotel, Lutenhoo was raided by thieves who stole hundreds of thousands of pounds worth of Russian artifacts from Lady Zia's collection. And other items were sold off at auction in 2000, making more than £20 million. Most of the remaining Lutenhoo's collection is now on display at Rangers House in London. The article is accompanied by many photographs of elegantly dressed ladies and gentlemen of that period, and one amazing photograph of Lady Zia with her golden retriever, whose speciality was to play the piano for visitors. The photograph shows this rather large golden retriever sitting on the piano stool with its front paw on the piano keys, playing I know not what.
Hello, I'm Deborah. The Coleman Column. Best-selling novelist and mum of four, Rowan Coleman, shares the chaos and comedy of her life in the county. Lighting Little Beacons. I read somewhere that adults, of a certain age, always feel a bit more doomy. It might be because they have children, or a mortgage, or a sudden sense of their own mortality, but it is around the mid-40s that we start to worry in earnest about the possibility of a nuclear meltdown, terrorist attacks, and madmen with automatic weapons. The world can seem like a dark place. I say this not to push you over the brink, but as a way to shine a little light of hope. Bear with me. Recently, I was in Yorkshire, Haworth to be precise, visiting the former home of my beloved Bronte sisters. When the family lived there in the first half of the 19th century, it was a dangerous place to live. Average adult life expectancy was around 25 years, and infant mortality was over 40%. As I walked around the churchyard of the village chapel, where Patrick, the father of Charlotte, Emily and Anne, was priest, I saw headstones that listed as many as 16 infants buried beneath, from one family, too numerous to name individually. How dark and grim life must have seemed there, how hopeless and full of sorrow. There was no non-stop internet or 24-hour news bringing tragedy to homes, but there was a funeral taking place outside the parsonage windows at least once every single day. And as for Patrick, he saw everyone he loved, from his beloved wife Maria to his last surviving child Charlotte, taken from him. How easy it would have been to despair, to give up his faith and hide away from the light, but like his daughters, he never did. Rather, he strived even harder to give life meaning. A remarkably modern man, he continued to work tirelessly for his parish, bringing health reform, fresh water, education and pastoral care to so many. Wherever he looked, he sought to shine a light. I often lie awake at night and I worry myself sick at the state of the world. But then I stop and think, well, how can I shine a light today? Often I try to do that through my writing, sometimes through donating to charities or supporting causes by providing my time and skills. But there are many easier ways to shine a light every day. Be kind to people you know and people you don't. Don't tut at the elderly lady taking her time at the checkout. Smile at her instead. Help her with her packing. Ask your friends how they are and be interested in the answer and ready to offer support if you can. Make time to watch the leaves falling, listen to the birds singing, or your children talking endlessly about Minecraft. Be aware of the beauty that is all around us, despite everything. Individually, it's easy to feel small and powerless. But if we each shine a light the best we can, whenever we can, then soon enough we'll have enough power to illuminate the world.
Hello, I'm Jilly. Heart's dog foster carer, Nigel, has just fostered his 10th animal as part of the Dogs Trust Freedom Project, an innovative scheme for owners fleeing domestic abuse who need a temporary home for their pets. His surname has been withheld to protect his identity. Several months after losing my own dog, I bumped into a friend and mentioned that although I missed the company and interaction, I wasn't sure I had the long-term commitment needed to own another dog. My friend suggested I looked at the Dogs Trust Freedom Project, which combines the benefits of fostering a dog for around 6 months with the satisfaction of helping the owner during a period of family turmoil. After a couple of weeks, I was entrusted with my first dog. The rest, as they say, is history. Don't assume the dog will effortlessly fit into its new surroundings. Everything will be new and scary. The animal has been taken away from maybe the only home it has ever known. Never forget that having to learn new routines and boundaries will cause stress. Imagine it from the dog's point of view and don't expect miracles. Other attributes are pretty standard, such as patience, allowing time and space for the dog to adapt, and last but not least, showing affection. When I first started working for the project, I anticipated all the usual expectations from caring for dogs, such as healthy walks, companionship and friendly interactions. What I now realise is that I've also gained a huge amount of satisfaction, enjoyment and pride from doing something tangible and worthwhile. I have cared for a wide range of dogs, such as Rottweiler, Poodle, Labrador, Staffy, Husky and several crossbreeds. Every one of them displayed a complex individual personality, who after gaining their trust, rewarded me with loyalty and affection. You should never judge a dog by the first impression. One of my dogs was a heavily built, muscular Staffy that had several scars on her face. My first thoughts were that she was tough, aloof and unfriendly. Nothing could have been further from the truth. Every night she refused to stay in her bed until I had cocooned her in a blanket, and I'm sure she purred as she cuddled up next to me on the sofa. I can honestly say that as I think back to their times with me, every dog brings a smile to my face. Dogs may arrive confused and anxious, but every dog is an individual, and although they may appear confident as they walk in, they could spend the next couple of hours hiding in a corner. Getting to know them is important. The greatest joy, which may take hours or even days, is the moment you realise you have gained their trust. It might be as simple as taking a biscuit from your hand without flinching, or perhaps nudging you for another back scratch. When that moment happens, it brings a smile and makes the smallest amount of effort worthwhile.
In the final, the sixth session, where we've been looking at the fundamentals of the Islam belief, and I've been chatting with Akhtar Zaman, the president of the Islamic Center in St. Albans, we've covered the pillars of Islam and we've had a basis to this. And what Akhtar suggested that we might talk about is the area of human rights, because it's an issue that would often raise its head when we think about Islam in the modern world. Why did you think that human rights are something we should be raising as an issue?
It's a very important aspect of Islam that seems to get overlooked. It's actually enshrined in the basic belief and it's written in the Quran. So this is God's law. We as Muslims believe this is God's law. And He has told us what human rights are and how we are to behave. Sometimes we kind of look at what's going on around the world today and we get a completely different picture to what reality is. Some of the things we hear about, they're not necessarily a view of Islam. This is something that individuals or groups have carried out. And of course, they are always then seen as Muslims carrying that out, which means that it must be Islam which is telling them to do that. In fact, you know, sanctity of life, respect for others, children, adults, women, you know, this is all very clearly defined within the Quran as to how, you know, you must behave with each of these types of humans or individuals.
Fighting through the misunderstandings which one senses that we get from the quick and easy media coverage, as it were, there's often been the line that the Quran and that Islam says, if you kill one man, you kill humanity.
Correct.
And that seems to be completely contrary to the impression we often have of Islam.
Absolutely. You know, there are times when, if I could use this word loosely, it's permitted, because if somebody is about to kill you and you defend yourself, then you can be forgiven for that. But to go out with a calm mind and say, I'm going to just kill somebody or detonate a bomb as a suicide bomber, that is prohibited. You mentioned yourself, to kill somebody is the equivalent of killing all of mankind. And that's in the Quran. Yet all we hear about these days is, oh, well, you know, as a Muslim, you're going to detonate a bomb and just kill people for the sake of it. No.
When we were talking about Hajj, you referred to the sins and the cleansing of the sins, getting closer to God to understand where you've been going wrong and how you can correct that. And it seems to me perfectly logical in Islam, as in other religions, that people get it wrong. They may state a belief, they may hold to a belief, they may have been brought up in a belief, but they don't always get it right. So why shouldn't we look at the certain aspects of what some Muslims do, both in this country and the world in general, and say, well, that's not because they're Muslims. That's because they got it wrong.
That's correct. And, you know, one of the other things that we need to be very clear about is the fact that just because they're Muslims and they carry out an act doesn't mean they're doing it because they're Muslim. They're doing it because they want to do it.
Yeah. They're a man or they're a criminal or they're a bully or like every other human being.
And again, without getting too political, we hear about some of the atrocities which have happened in Belgium and France recently. And, you know, it's like, oh, the Muslims are doing this, they've come in. These people who carried out these atrocities were actually living in that country. They were known to the authorities to be of a particular type of person.
Let's look at the different aspects of human rights, because within the context you've often said during our conversations, God tells us to do this. So you accept, if I may put it crudely, that God has rights.
Yes, yes.
That's one side of the coin.
Absolutely.
But what you're saying is there are human rights on the other side, not against God, but within God's understanding.
Correct.
Or the understanding of God.
So there are certain rights that God has, and he's very clearly defined them, and what we as believers have to do. And then, of course, he's also taught us how to lead a good life and interact with other human beings or mankind, whether it's your parents, whether it's your neighbors, whether it's your children, whether it's somebody elderly who lives nearby, whether it's an orphan. So each of these has a prescribed way of interacting with them. And it all boils down to kindness, generosity, respect, and making life easier for these people.
So you would have respect for the older people because of, by virtue of the fact that they are your parents or whatever.
Yes.
In Judaism, the mother is a very important root of continuity, as it were. What's in Islam?
Each of them has their own rights, but the mother, if I could take you back to a story that was narrated when a person went to ask the Prophet, what rights do my parents have over me and who has the most right? And the first response was, your mother. So the question was asked again. And after that, the second response was, your mother. The question was asked. So after that, the third response was, your mother. The fourth time was, your father. So according to the scriptures and the traditions of the Prophet, the mother has three times as many rights as your father. One, she went through labour and pain to give you birth. She nurtured you, helped you grow up. When you fell down, she was there for you. She fed you, etc. So a mother has many, many rights that need to be respected compared to the father. Of course, your father is an important figure in your life. However, it is stated that the path to paradise is within the footsteps of your mother.
And yet often we get the impression that the woman is, in some Islamic communities, is a second-rate person, and this doesn't seem to tie in.
It's an unfortunate, I would like to say, misnomer, but in some cultures it's a reality. But not because of Islam. That's more of a cultural thing. Islam has actually given quite a respected place to a woman. You know, some of the most important figures within Islam were women. And they had certain rights, and people respected that.
I have to say, I didn't know that. I had no impression. Yeah. I have an impression of Islam as being male-dominated from top to bottom, as it were. What is the role of these women?
If you go back over all the religious scriptures, then they were male-dominated. However, behind every male were the female figures. The two prominent ones that we've already mentioned, Mary, I mean, she's a very prominent figure within Islam. I'd say that even higher than in Christianity. I'm sure a lot of people would disagree with me on that, but because a whole chapter of the Quran is given to her and what she went through, similarly, you know, I've mentioned Hagar, the wife of Abraham, and then there were the wives of the Prophet and other similar prominent figures who came along. But because a lot of the Islamic world comes from a male-dominated culture, a lot of people seem to think that, you know, women don't have rights. They have rights. In fact, Islam gave more rights to women 1400 years ago than they have in the Western world today. But a lot of people don't know that.
We've talked about sanctity of life. We've talked about the role of the woman, albeit briefly. Mm. What about workers' rights and slavery?
Slavery is a fact that's happened. No one can say that's happened due to religion. It's just something that culturally used to happen. And Saudi Arabia as it is today, or Arabia as it was at the time, was no different. Slaves were taken from Africa and made to do the work. However, at the time of the Prophet, when Islam started to take hold, there were certain rights given to the slaves. And where possible, the Prophet asked their masters to free them. And those who accepted Islam did that freely. Some actually went as far as to purchase slaves from others so they could free them and get the closeness or nearness of their creator that way as well. One of the closest companions of the Prophet was Bilal, who was of Abyssinian or African descent. He was a black male who used to have a lisp when he spoke as well. And of course, there were other prominent people from the Quraysh tribe, which was the tribe of the Prophet, who thought that they should have a better position than him. But no, the Prophet chose him. You hear about the five times call to prayer. When this happened at the time of the Prophet, he asked Bilal to perform that duty, which was such an important duty. So Bilal, who was black, was treated equally. He was freed from being a slave because his master, when he found out he'd accepted Islam, tried to punish him through torture and so on. But Bilal stood fast and said, no, there is only one God. Mm. And when the companions of the Prophet saw this, they spoke to him about it and they were able to buy him and free him. And he became a very prominent figure within Islam.
It's quite interesting because it's a quite interesting symbol, because not only is he a black African, a slave, but he has a speech impediment.
Exactly.
He's bringing everything together and talking about the value of the worth of an individual.
Absolutely. And that's a perfect summary. I think you've summarised it better than I could there, Rob.
Yeah. What about modern day slaves is now theoretically history, but not in fact, but almost. Workers' rights are often an issue.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, it's written in the Quran very clearly that if you ask somebody to do some work for you, make sure you pay them what they merit as a wage and do not delay it in any way. If they've done a good day's work for you, then pay them for that day. If they've done it for a week, pay them for the week, and as quickly as possible, because clearly they're doing it to earn a living, and by you delaying it could cause them harm.
Do you see that in Islam it in any way changes? I mean, if you're an employer of lots of people working for you, does it change that you have obligations as an employer, not just in the paying for the work, but in the way you treat those workers?
Absolutely. So, you know, you've got to treat them so that they are not in danger. They're able to carry out the duties that you're asking them to do.
Sort of health and safety.
Health and safety, absolutely. Absolutely. So in modern day terminology, that's exactly what it is. There are many stories where something like this happened, where somebody came and did some work, but they'd left before they were paid for it. However, that person who asked them to carry out the work kept that money, invested it as it grew, whatever it grew to. When he met them afterwards, he gave them the whole lot, saying, "This is yours." They said, "Well, no, I only did half a day's work for you. How can this be?" No, I invested it on your behalf. This is what it's become now. So this is all yours.
One of the things we often hear is that if you're a Muslim, you can't invest and in certain ways, and you can't make a profit on it. I'm a little bit confused now, because that story suggests you can invest.
Yes, I mean, investment is not prohibited in any way whatsoever. What's prohibited in Islam is to earn money from others where it's known as interest. Interest is prohibited in Islam, giving and taking of interest on money. But if you were to invest it in some way, for instance, let's take it back to the times of the Prophet. For instance, if you were able to buy two camels, which was commodity at the time, and of course they had further camels from that, and that grew, then of course your investment is growing. What the Islamic banks do these days is, for instance, you know, people need to borrow money, but what they don't say is, I want to borrow £1,000 and the interest rate will be 3%, so therefore I'm going to pay back this amount. No, it doesn't work like that, because then interest comes into interest is prohibited.
Okay.
What they tend to do is say, okay, I will buy whatever it is for you, but then I'm going to sell it to you. So I'm going to buy it for £1,000, I'm going to sell it to you for £1,100. So you have to pay me £1,100. So that's how you get
it. And is that part of Sharia?
It is.
Banking Sharia law?
You've touched on a point where it's a bad word in the Western world, Sharia law. But if you were to actually look at the actual laws, I mean, what it is, it's based on Quranic teaching supplemented by needs of the day without going against the original Quranic law. So that's what Sharia law is. So it's supposed to be to help everybody, bring a lot more justice, equality, etc. However, a lot of people seem to associate Sharia law with chopping people's heads off. No, that's not what it's about.
Okay. Well, I think one would have to explore all the aspects.
Yeah.
How would one do that? Is the Sharia law so literally based upon the holy book, the holy books, that it's all there? Or is that where it's derived?
Most of it is there, because the holy book does cover a lot of law. So we talk about the rights of people, we cover about lending of money, about interest and how you should not give or take interest if it's at all possible. It's how you treat other people, how you treat guests. It's all in there. However, you know, it's not going to have every single scenario that you can come across. So what you can do is say, okay, well, based on that, we're not contravening any of that, but we need additional. For instance, an example I give is, it's not going to tell you what time you have to switch off your streetlights. It just won't.
Right.
However, based on the teachings, what you've got to think about is, well, if I switch them off too early, is it going to hamper the people? If I leave them on too long, is it going to waste money that belongs to the public? This is the thought process you go through, which links it to the Sharia law.
So does a Muslim, in a mixed community like ours, where you have all faiths and none, as it were, does a Muslim find it easy to work within the broader community? I mean, you yourself are a professional, you work, you have a business that is involved in information technology or whatever. Is it easy for a Muslim to be just like any other person in the context of the bigger community?
There are certain things where it's difficult. And I remember when I first got introduced to this community, etc., it was different. because I found it that so there were certain things which were different. However, having lived here and gone through, if I could say, certain pains, I'm actually a better person for it, with a better understanding of why certain things happen and how they relate back to my faith as well.
Okay. So being a Muslim, you don't feel excluded.
No.
You feel you can bring your judgment to your situation.
Correct. Okay. Yeah. I'm quite a vocal person, although people used to say I was an introvert. Somehow I've become a bit more of a vocal person now. I like to actually debate and discuss these things with people, you know, why does certain thing happen in a certain way? And normally I believe that history and religion normally provides an answer as to why certain things happen in a certain way.
Thank you. We're going to go into our discussion. Our next session will be with the other two gentlemen, Canon Tony Hill and Rabbi Rafi, and we'll bring together some of the issues that we've raised with each of you, and look forward to those discussions.
I look forward to it too, Rob.
Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Well, thanks as ever to all who've helped produce and distribute this programme, to Alex and Bill for recording and editing the news section and putting it all together, to our four newsreaders today, to Terry, Deborah and Jilly, who read the magazine articles in part two, to Akhtar Zaman for his help in enabling us to understand a little more about Islam, and of course to Sue for the radio listening suggestions, and to the other Sue and to Richard for copying and distributing the programme. And thanks to you for listening, of course. Steve will be bringing you the latest edition of News Extra next week, and I hope to be with you again myself in 4 weeks' time. Until then, take care. Bye-bye. That's the end of the Red Saturn programme for the month of April 2018.